Good morning.
Hey, I hope you're all enjoying the really cold weather I ordered up for you.
Yeah, thank you.
Anytime. In fact, if you want, I can even make it colder tomorrow. And the next day.
I just hope you all don't freeze somewhere. It seems like in Southern Oregon, if we're going to get really cold weather, it always comes just before Christmas, usually about a week later than this. But the jet stream just kind of dips down, and boy, it's got some cold weather coming for us right now. So maybe that'll be a good incentive to stay indoors and study for your exams or something, so that you don't feel so much like going outside and just freezing in position when you walk out the door. Anyway, crazy tea. So a couple of announcements. Don't forget the last assignment is due tomorrow, so make sure you do that. Pay close attention to it, because there will be a couple, three questions on the final exam that come from that. Some of the more obvious things that you're reading about in that. I will have those graded and put out into the boxes, hopefully Monday. That's my plan. And so you can come by and pick that up and look at the grading key for that. So don't forget about that. Lab, finishing up this week. The one thing that, or two things you may still be holding on to right now, is your lab homework, so make sure that you get that in. And you know, we're doing something very different this week where we're having you work in groups on that homework. So make sure you get that in. And also the peer evaluations that you do for the project, the enzyme project. Your lab instructors need to get those by tomorrow. So make sure that you get those turned in to your lab instructors so that they can see how it all went in your groups. Yeah. When are the final grades supposed to be up again? That's a great question. When I have my grades, I'll post them in the box out in the hall where I post things by where you pick up assignments and stuff. Final grades, though, for all of your grades appear after they, what we call after they roll. That means that they become permanent grades. And, you know, I'm just not sure whether that's going to happen Monday night or Tuesday night. Usually it's that one of those nights, and as soon as that happens, then the next day they become available. But, as I noted in the email that I sent out to you, all of you yesterday, in order to get access to your final grades early, you need to have done all of your course evaluations. So you've gotten an email about that, telling you where to go, what the website is, and so forth, to evaluate the courses. If you get that all done, then as soon as the grades become available, you can access them. If you don't get that all done for whatever reason, then it's like the following Friday when you can get in and access your grades. So a little bit of incentive there to do the course evaluations. So just be aware of that. If you find a hold on your record, and you wonder what is that hold, I think it's a CV hold or something, it's the course evaluation hold that will come off a week from I guess 2 weeks from Friday is when it'll come off. It also prevents you from accessing your registration and a few other things. So they have a stranglehold on you for those course evaluations. Okay, and so the final exam online will open on Wednesday, be open all day Thursday, close on Thursday. Now that's a different time again, right? It shifted from when the first three quizzes were. So, but it does span when you would be in here, sitting here, taking the exam if we were doing it in the classroom. So 5 o'clock Wednesday it opens, 5 o'clock Thursday it closes. You'll have 2 hours for it once you start. So don't start too close to 5 o'clock on Thursday, because you'll quickly run out of time if you do that. And the things I've talked with you about, cumulative, about 60% on the new material, about 40% on what I've already quizzed you on. The last three labs, lecture assignments 5 and 6. 5 really just kind of looks at stuff that we talked about in lecture, though, so that's not so critical. About 4 times as many questions, give or take, and so forth. Question and answer sessions, Tuesday and Wednesday at 12:30 in the lab room. So please plan on coming by to those if you've got questions, or drop by my office next week. That's fine. I'll be in my office all next week, so you can do that. And remember, I told you last time that if you score at least 10% better on the final exam, that I will double your final exam grade and throw away your four quizzes. So at least 10% better than the four quizzes, and your final exam takes precedence. I do that because it's a cumulative exam. You've got to go back. You've got to look over everything anyway. And I'm trying to give you some incentive to get in there and really take a look at the material. So 10% better, and I'll double that score. So you can really, if you've been struggling with the quizzes up to this point, it's a way to bring that grade up quite a bit by doing that. Okay, so that's the stuff that's coming that you need to be aware of, and I don't think I've forgotten any announcements. So let's move on. Now, last time we looked at the cell cycle, right, and a little bit at the parts of it. So the sorts of things that you've been doing in lab this week, we looked at last time in lecture. The cell cycle, referring to that alternation between interphase, which was where the cell was accumulating materials, it was growing bigger. We know that sometime during interphase, the DNA is getting replicated. If the cell is going to divide, it's getting replicated, so that when we come to that M phase, or that division phase, we're set and ready to go. And we know now that there are kind of checkpoints along the way, too, that are being watched for. So, for example, until the DNA is completely replicated, that cell should go into a division phase. Sometimes those checkpoints fail us. And one of the things that kind of leads to tumor formation is the failure, perhaps, of some of those checkpoints along the way because of mutation or whatever. But in general, there are several checkpoints along the way to make sure that before a cell starts to divide, everything has been accomplished up to that point so that it can successfully divide. So the alternation between interphase and M phase, right? We're going between the accumulation and growth and the division. We talked about how the DNA itself in interphase is really strong out, like that loose ball of yarn. We call it chromatin, right? So if we were able to see the DNA in interphase, we would see that it's very, very loosely strung out. It would be the chromatin phase. But then as we begin into the M phase, the division phase, we saw that DNA becomes highly, highly coiled and folded, we call condensed, becomes very, very condensed to form those little compact structures, the chromosomes. So in interphase, chromatin, in M phase, the division phase, chromosomes. And the chromosomes are nice and compact, so we can actually divide them up. We can move them to opposite sides of the cell. Whereas the chromatin, we'd never be able to do that. So alternation of those things between the two major parts of the cell division cycle. So some important things going on there. IPMAT, remember the little acronym to kind of help you to remember the stages of this whole process, I, interphase, and then as we go into the division cycle, prophase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase, that you were working with in lab this week, or you're going to be working with today in lab. Again, make sure you pay careful attention to those things. You've got diagrams in the lecture notes that are designed to kind of help explain this again if you need any more explanation for this. And remember, these diagrams are just of the nucleus in here. Again, so we're not looking at the whole cell here. We're just looking at what's going on in the nucleus. And if we were looking at the whole cell, then we'd have a larger cell membrane drawn around that and so forth. So as you're examining those, keep that in mind. Now, what you're modeling in lab and what you have drawn here are for animal division, animal mitotic divisions. Remember, I made a distinction between mitosis and cytokinesis also last time, so that the mitosis was the division of the nucleus. giving us two identical nuclei, genetically identical nuclei, usually followed by cytokinesis, which was the dividing of the cytoplasm. And so we wind up with two identical cells. But again, there are some tissues where the cells are multinucleate, where the nuclei divide and divide, and the cytoplasm doesn't divide. That's probably, you know, that's the exception rather than the rule. Certainly, we don't have that going on within us. I can't think of any higher organisms that have something like that going on, but some of the lower, what we call lower organisms, do that. So distinction between mitosis and cytokinesis. Be aware of that. So we're really, in these diagrams, we're really not going to see cytokinesis going on, because we're just looking at the division of the nucleus there. And that, again, that was animal. Now, hopefully you picked up in lab some of the differences between animal and plant mitotic divisions. Okay, there are just a couple of differences. For example, when we look at animals, they have these little structures, these centrioles, and they've been kind of mistakenly drawn here. They really should be T-shaped, and they're kind of an upside-down T with the top of the T facing the nucleus. So if drawn properly, these would all kind of look like that. Okay, I'm not going to go through and try to withdraw them all. And that's because each one of these is a pair of centrioles, right? And sometimes you'll hear them referred to as centrosomes. In the lab manual, it refers, well, the centrosome is actually the whole structure with the centriole in the middle. In the lab manual, we just look at the centrioles themselves. And one of the first things that you can see when you're looking at animal cells that are starting to divide, plant cells don't have centrioles, so this doesn't count for them, but animal cells, is that those centrioles start moving. And as they're moving, they're starting to form these spindly fibers facing the outside that are called the spindle fibers, right? Something that you were asked to look up in lab. And so that's oftentimes one of the earliest indications. We're looking at cells, oh, look, it's starting to divide, because we start to see this kind of activity going on. We see that the chromatin is now condensing. We're starting to see chromosomes take form in the nucleus and so forth. Very, very early events. So in plant cells, we don't see that because there are no centrioles, and because there are no centrioles, there are no astral rays that form. Now, interestingly enough, people used to look, a lot of work was done early on with with animals, and people came to recognize that the centrioles not only would organize these astral rays, but they'd also organize the spindle fibers, the fibers that are going to go across the middle and actually attach to the chromosomes and pull the chromatids apart. They seem to be organizing that also in animals, and people really puzzled. And they thought, well, how can mitosis occur in plants when they don't have centrioles? You know, what's going on? What's organized? Are the centrioles really necessary for that? But experiments done with lasers, really, really fine micro lasers, where they literally go in and burn out the centrioles in the cell, they discovered that, sure enough, if they didn't have the centrioles, they wouldn't get the spindle fibers forming. So again, plants don't have them. What's going on? Well, something else is organizing them in plants, and we haven't identified that yet. We don't know what's organizing them, but we know that in plants, just like in animals, you get these spindle fibers that go across the middle of the cell that ultimately are responsible for separating the chromosomes. So centrioles in animals, no centrioles in plants. The other big difference was in cytokinesis. You were looking at, we talked last time about there were two different kinds of cytokinesis. There was in animals that cleavage furrow would form, literally proteins wrapped around the middle of the cell that are very much like the proteins that you have in your muscle that allow your muscles to contract. Only when they contract, they do it kind of like tightening a belt so that squeezes in and in and eventually pinches the cell in two so that we wind up with two cells. Animal cells can do it that way because they don't have a rigid cell wall around them, right? They've just got a cell membrane. Plant cells, though, have that rigid cell wall. There's no way to take that cell wall and squeeze that in. So remember from lab, where you were looking at the onion root tips, you were asked to identify that cell plate. The cell wall starts to form across the middle early on in telophase, once the chromosomes are at the opposite poles, you see that cell wall starting to form. At first, it's just a really light line, and then it gets thicker. Eventually, a whole new cell wall will form across the middle, and membrane will fill in behind it. So we wind up then with two cells from one. So, you know, the big differences between plant and animal. Animals have centrioles, plants don't, so we see some things there. And cytokinesis, animals do squeeze in the middle with cleavage furrow, and plants form a new cell wall. Here's a diagram of that in plants where you see this new cell wall starting to form across, well, that's formed across the middle, and walls off those two cells. Okay, so make sure that you spend some time reviewing these things, knowing the different stages, because there will be questions on the final exam about these, asking you to identify the different stages, to know which stage comes before which stage, and other things associated with this process. Now, last time I showed you a video, which is available to you. You can look at it anytime you want, as a link off of my review page. And I thought, just to kind of pull this together real quickly, I would show you another one of those videos that are available there also to kind of try to fix all of this process in mind. And again, make a point of the fact that even though we divide this up into stages, in the cell, it's one process that goes from beginning to end, right? It just one stage moves into the next, moves into the next. So in back, if you could close those doors.
We pass through the plasma membrane, revealing the nuclear envelope with its pores. There are two centrosomes to the right of the nucleus and a nucleolus within it. During prophase, the chromatin is condensing. Each chromosome consists of two chromatids. The nucleolus breaks down and the centrosomes move apart, building spindle and asters as they go. The disappearance of the nuclear membrane marks the beginning of prometaphase. During prometaphase, the spindle invades the nuclear region. Spindle fibers are forming and breaking down. Capture spindle fibers, they stabilize them by giving them something to pull against. The captured chromosomes are pulled to the equatorial plane and the cell is in metaphase. As we move our camera, you can see the metaphase arrangement on the equatorial plane. The centromeres divide, allowing anaphase to begin. Two processes are going on. The spindle fibers shorten, and the poles move apart. Both processes move the chromosomes toward their destinations. We back away to observe the events of telophase. The spindle breaks down, and the chromosomes elongate as the chromatin uncoils. Nuclear envelopes form, and then nucleoli. parent cells, each genetically identical to the parent cell.
Let's do this one. So here we have some animal cells. Their chromosomes, you can see, are being lined up across. They're in metaphase right now. They're lined up across the middle. You can't really see the spindle fibers really well. There's anaphase. From the moment those chromatids start to separate until they get to the opposite poles, anaphase, and we move into telophase. And it went through cytokinesis so fast I couldn't even talk about it. Okay, but you saw the contractile. Well, you can see the fibers, but you saw the contraction around the middle. So there we are again in metaphase. Anaphase. At the end, there's telophase and a cytokinesis going on. This is obviously time-lapse photography. I don't know exactly how long this process takes in real life, but I'm guessing it's not a terribly long process, maybe 30 minutes to an hour. Nah, 30 minutes is probably a better estimation. And you just keep the body.
DNA technology. Okay, now we've talked about the DNA molecule. We've got a pretty good handle on how it's put together. We've talked about how we're starting to better understand what goes on with the messenger RNA before it actually leaves the nucleus out into the cytoplasm. Given all this information, and I should say it's just getting easier and easier, quicker and quicker to sequence DNA. And so, given all this information that we have, what can we do with it, or what are people doing with it? And so that's kind of this whole area of DNA technology. So we're going to jump back now. We had jumped ahead to look at the cell cycle. Let's jump back to page 65 now, where we kind of left off after talking about mutation. Now, I do have one bit of good news for you. Remember I told you you need to look at these pages about mutation, different kinds of mutations and mutagens and so forth. And number four there, in chemical mutagens, those that interfere with the proper assembly of DNA during replication or the repair. An example is caffeine. You can cross that off. Caffeine is no longer considered to be a problem with DNA replication or repair. So all of you coffee drinkers, good news, you can continue drinking your coffee and not worry about your chromosomes falling apart and crumbling. So, DNA technology. This was all kind of started with the discovery of a class of enzymes in bacteria that came to be known as restriction endonucleases. So, you've got that term there in the lecture notes, restriction endonucleases. Okay, what in the world does that mean? Well, what people saw, bacteria, when they grow, are incredible scavengers of DNA from the environment. I don't know that there's a piece of DNA that a bacterium didn't like. They just will bring back to DNA that's in the environment in. Now, DNA in the environment doesn't last very long. but they'll find it. Remember back with Griffith's experiments and the transforming factor? What that was is DNA that had been released when those virulent bacteria had been heat killed. They released DNA, and then the non-virulent bacteria were sucking that DNA up, and they were bringing it in, and that DNA that they got from the virulent bacteria was transforming them, was replacing a region of their own DNA so that they now had the capability of building that capsule and becoming virulent. So bacteria do that, but a lot of the DNA that they take in is likely to be harmful to them, and who knows what they're getting as they're bringing that in. And so there's the possibility of that DNA being harmful. But over time, DNA have developed protective mechanisms for that. And what they'll do, once they take that DNA in, is they'll cut it up into small pieces using enzymes, using endonucleases. So an endonuclease, it refers to the fact that it's going to be breaking down nucleic acids. And in this particular case, we're looking at ones that break down DNA. So if you can imagine a long DNA molecule, an endonuclease is going to cut it up into smaller pieces like this. Endo means that it's cutting it on the inside. If that had been an exonuclease, if there are exonucleases also, then it would be chopping away at the ends from the outside and breaking it up that way. But these are endo, they're cutting it up on the inside. Restriction, because they were, you can kind of think of it as they were restricting the ability of that DNA to cause damage to the cell. And we know a lot more about that now, that there are labeling patterns, all sorts of things. You know, it's like, okay, if DNA have these endonucleases in their cells, how do they keep from cutting up their own DNA? Because remember, the DNA is right there in the cytoplasm with everything else. There's no nucleus or anything separating it out. And we know now that there are small identifying chemicals that are added to the DNA that serve a protective function so that the bacteria doesn't chop up its own DNA, but it will chop up other. Now, what was really kind of fascinating about these restriction endonucleases is that they're very specific for certain sequences of bases. So not just randomly cutting things up by any means. They're not just looking for pairs of bases. Now, with some of our digestive enzymes that we use to digest proteins, some of the early ones are just looking for certain pairs of amino acids. And when they find that pair of amino acids, they'll cut the peptide bond that's holding them together. And that'll start breaking that larger protein down into smaller proteins. These endonucleases are looking for palindromic regions. They're looking for palindromes. Now, you know what a palindrome is? It's a word or a phrase that reads the same in both directions. So, for example, Wairika Bakery, which no longer exists, sadly. Wairika Bakery it reads the same in either direction. That's a palindrome. There are a lot of palindromes out there that you can find. I just can't remember what they all are right now. What's that?
Race car.
Oh, okay, that would be, yeah. Okay, race car and so forth. Well, what these endonucleases are looking for is palindromic regions on the DNA. So, for example, we might have a region that looks like this. AAGCTT. Okay, so there's just a little sequence of the DNA molecule. Well, what would its complementary, what would the other strand look like? Well, it would be TTCGAA. So, and remember, these are reading, they're anti-parallel, so they're running in opposite directions to each other. So this strand would be read, if this strand were read in this direction, this strand would be read in this direction. As you're getting the same message from each of these strands of DNA. So those are palindromic regions. And it turns out that the endonucleases are generally looking for either a 4-nucleotide or a 6-nucleotide or an 8-nucleotide region. And when they find those, the specific ones, then they'll bind to the region and they'll cut the molecule at that point. There are two ways that they'll cut it. Let's suppose we've got the enzyme sitting on here now. It's identified this as the region. So one way would be to cut it right like this, so that both of those bonds between the same pair in essence are cut. So you wind up with something like this and this. Once that's cut, and any time this enzyme finds this particular 6-nucleotide palindrome, it's going to make that cut. It's going to cut it up into smaller pieces. These are what we call blunt ends. Because they're blunt ends. You'll see the difference in just a second. Because the other way that the enzyme might cut it is not a straight across like this, but it might cut it offset. And so let me redraw this. Sorry, you got a slightly different palindrome there, but you can make the effect there. I just wound up with this larger. So there's our palindrome again, and rather than cutting it down the middle, and that could be in wherever, however this enzyme particularly works, to make blunt ends, it could cut it, say, here and here. Okay? So what we wind up with when that happens is something that looks like this. So that would be on one side, and on the other side, something that looks like this. And these are what we call sticky ends. Sticky ends because there's the potential for them coming back together. Okay, we've broken it apart, but we've got these small complementary sequences here where they can come back together, and there are enzymes in the cell that, if that happened, they would reconnect them together so that we could repair this if it got cut with sticky ends, or we can take advantage of this and do a lot of other things with it. So actually, we use both blunt ends and sticky ends, the cutters, for different things. It depends, you know. We'll use a blunt end cutter if we really don't necessarily want to bring the pieces back together again. We're doing something else with them. On the other hand, we'll use a sticky end cutter if we either want to bring these pieces back together, or maybe we want to insert another piece of DNA in there, and so forth. So we can use the sticky end cutters to do that. So this kind of opened up the whole field of DNA technology. It gave us the ability to start manipulating the DNA, to investigating the DNA in various ways that we didn't have before. So what do we do with that? A lot of different things that we might make use of this. So the first thing you've got listed there is gene cloning. Gene cloning is exactly what it sounds like, cloning genes. Suppose we have a gene that we would find really useful if there were a way to create more of that gene for one reason or another. So if there are a way to clone that gene, to make more copies of that gene, that might really, really be useful. One of the first examples of gene cloning that was done was to take the mammalian gene for insulin, clone it, put it into a bacterium, and allow then that bacterium to produce insulin. And that's how most insulin is produced now. It used to be insulin was collected from animal sources and stuff, really, really expensive because of the what you had to go through. But now, overnight, you can let bacteria make you a whole flask full of insulin, and then you just have to go ahead and purify it, get rid of the bacterial proteins and so forth, and now you've got insulin. So that's the sort of thing that one of the things one might do with gene cloning. Now, how do we go about doing that? Bacteria turn out to be really useful for these things. Because I told you they've got a single chromosome, right? A single circular chromosome in the bacterial cell. But oftentimes they have another little piece of DNA in that cell also called a plasmid. So here's our singular chromosome. Okay, but there may be a little plasmid off to the side. And that's that picture on page 65. You've got a little piece of an electron micrograph of the larger circular bacterial chromosome and then the little small plasmid sitting on the side there. Now, plasmids are interesting. Well, let me step back. Bacterial chromosomes, the bacteria themselves, compared to eukaryotic cells, don't have a lot of genes on them. But, you know, they may have in the hundreds of genes on a bacterial chromosome. A plasmid tends to only carry maybe 4 or 5 genes. Really, a very, very small number of genes. And so you might say, well, why in the world do bacteria even have these things? Oftentimes, one of the genes that you find on a plasmid is a gene that gives that bacterium antibiotic resistance. It's one of the reasons that bacteria can develop antibiotic resistance so fast is because they'll share these plasmids around. And they can actually they share them across species. It doesn't have to be the same species. These plasmids can be shared between species. So the plasmids have a very, very limited amount of information they carry, but generally they carry some very, very important genes for the bacteria. One of the earliest plasmids that was identified had to do with, believe it or not, what we might identify as sexual reproduction of bacteria. Say, wait a minute, how can that possibly be? But the bacteria do have some bacteria, anyway, have a process where they go through where they actually will kind of fuse together through a little tunnel-like port, and they'll share their genetic material back and forth. And it turned out that one of the genes that really encouraged that was found on a plasmid. So if they had that plasmid, then they would be doing that. If they didn't, at a much, much lower rate, they'd be doing it. And so we now know that a lot of the antibiotic resistant genes are on the plasmids and so forth. So what we do is we go in and we take advantage of this. We don't care about the bacterial chromosome itself. I mean, that's useful for other reasons, but not for gene cloning. What we'll do is we'll take the plasmid. There are ways to harvest plasmids. So you got a flask full of bacteria and you centrifuge them down and you got this bacteria muck and you. There are ways to break them open. To shock them, to break them open, and then you can isolate the plasmids so that you can wind up with a little test tube full of plasmids. And you've gotten rid of the other DNA, you've just got the plasmid DNA. Now, if we've got a gene that we want to clone, of course the trick here is to having the gene available that we want to clone. So we've got a gene that we want to clone. What we would do is use the same restriction endonuclease on both opening up the plasmid and preparing the ends of the gene. So, and we'd want to use a sticky end endonuclease. So we would open up the plasmid, and it's now going to have, sticky ends. So there's the double helix sort of, and I tried to draw the sticky ends there so that could come back, and you could re-anneal those, you could put them back together. But our little gene that we want to insert has the same sticky ends. So you mix those together now, and a certain percent of the time, you'll wind up with this gene winding up in here, inserting itself into the plasmid. And then you hook that all back together. And now you've got some plasmids that have this gene in them. The story isn't over there. Now you've got to get the plasmids back into the bacteria. And some of the early ways of doing that involved electrical shock and so forth to try to make the bacteria more sensitive to picking up plasmids. Techniques have been improved over that, but you got to get the plasmid back into the bacteria. You got to identify those bacteria that are actually carrying the plasmid that has the gene inserted properly the way you want it. And there are all obvious techniques for doing that. And so you can wind up with a strain of bacteria now that are carrying the plasmid that have the gene that you're interested in copying. So once you get to that point, then really it's a matter of growing them up overnight and the bacteria make you a whole flask full of plasmids that have the gene. And then it's just go backwards, okay? Use the collect the plasmids again. Use the restriction endonuclease, doesn't have to be the same one, to get your gene out. And then what are you going to do with your gene? Well, then that's up to what you do with it. You may just want to leave it in the plasmid, like I said. If it were the insulin gene and you want the bacteria to make insulin, which is a protein, you want to make the insulin, then you just leave it there and you keep growing those bacteria up and harvesting the insulin. Or you can use that. Now you can take those genes that you've cloned and you can put them into other DNA, including other organisms, and that's the genetically modified organisms. The whole GMO debate is about genes that have been moved from one species to another species by using techniques like this, by taking that gene, cloning it, getting it into some sort of a system where it can go ahead and then be transferred to the other cells and so forth. So, gene cloning. One way of doing it is with the plasmids. Now, there's another way of doing gene cloning, which is a little bit faster, and that's what's used a lot anymore. It's nice if you can clone whole genes. This technique is oftentimes used to not necessarily clone whole genes, but certainly to clone regions of DNA so that you get multiple copies, and that's what's called the polymerase chain reaction. Polymerase chain reaction, or you'll probably recognize it, the letters PCR, can be used to, in a matter of a couple of hours, create millions of copies of a region of DNA that you're interested in amplifying now, in cloning. Polymerase chain reaction. Kind of an interesting story behind the polymerase chain reaction. The person that came up with this, which, by the way, won him a Nobel Prize, he was a graduate student in San Diego, and he tells the story that he was driving to visit his girlfriend, who lived somewhere in the valley or somewhere away. It was a few hour drive, and you know how you drive along, you just kind of, your mind's mulling things over, and all, he got this idea that this might be a way to make more DNA and stuff. So he took it home. And sure enough, by using the appropriate enzymes and by cycling and so forth, I mean, it's not the simplest process in the world, but it's really not that complicated either. He came up with this system of PCR that's now used for amplifying DNA in so many different instances, whether it's a forensic search trying to identify or trying to tie a person to a crime scene, or whether it's trying to figure out if an individual belongs to this family line or that family, looking at lineages, and it just goes on and on and on, what this is used for, gene cloning. So the PCR, the polymerase chain reaction, is used for that. By the way, it was really kind of funny, because when he received the Nobel Prize, he was described as an unemployed surfer. He was living in San Diego. He had finished his graduate work. He had not found a job. He was literally an unemployed surfer that won the Nobel Prize for this reaction that he came up with. Nice success story, you know. Maybe one of you could do that too, huh? In some area. So we have ways of cloning our genes, of increasing the number of copies and so forth. And that kind of brings us now to what we call genetic engineering. Genetic engineering. Now, remember the very first lecture, no, maybe the very second lecture or something, I was talking with you about science and what is science, and don't confuse the outcome of science with the science itself. The science is up here, up figuring out all this. Now we're down here, okay, genetic engineering. What can we do with this? What can we build? How can we use it? Now, it's not to say that you don't have to develop more science to do that, but we're kind of getting into the more practical application aspects when we talk about genetic engineering. So, let's suppose
we have an individual that has sickle cell anemia. Okay, now, you worked with sickle cell anemia in lab. Right? That was the mutation that at the end of exercise 8 it talked about, I think. We talked about it in lecture also, how the sickle cell gene is just a single base substitution that substitutes a single amino acid into that beta chain of hemoglobin, and it creates all this untold misery for the people that inherit it. Sickle cell is kind of interesting. It's an example of what we call incomplete dominance, because if you inherit two defective genes, then and you got it full on, you've got the problem. If you inherit one defective and one good gene, you got about half your hemoglobin that's defective and half that isn't. It's not nearly as bad, and yet it's still a problem for the people. But the good news is, it actually in areas with malaria, it gives those people a certain amount of resistance to malaria, because the misshaping of the red blood cell makes it so that the malaria parasite can't really go through its life cycle, which involves living in the red blood cells as well as out in the blood serum. And so that's the one bright and shining spot with sickle cell, is that if you've got full-blown sickle cell, you're pretty much immune to malaria if you're living in an area with malaria. Of course, malaria is a killer for people that get it. Of course, then you got to deal with the other problems of sickle cell and what that causes too. So let's say we've got an individual with sickle cell, and we thought, well, wouldn't it be cool if we could use genetic engineering? If we could go in and we could modify their cells, we could take a good stretch of DNA for that beta chain and insert it into the appropriate cells and then replace the defective one, the bad one, with a good one. And that's kind of the idea behind genetic engineering, at least one aspect of genetic engineering. How can we go in and modify things like that? So that raises all sorts of questions. First question maybe, well, how do you get DNA into a cell anyway? We're certainly not going to be able to use the techniques that we use for bacteria. I don't think we're going to put any of you into a test to disrupt all your cells, shock you, do all these other things, and then expect you to crawl out of the test tube again, right? You've got to use other techniques to be able to do that. And so the one delivery mechanism that has been used more than any other is viruses. Viruses infect human cells. And when a virus infects a human cell, its DNA gets inserted into the genome of the host. Okay, so viruses kind of are the perfect delivery mechanism if you want to deliver some DNA into a cell. Now, we call these things that we're going to use to deliver the DNA, a general term would be vectors. So what are we going to use for a vector? How are we going to deliver that DNA? Well, let's use a virus. Now, here are some of the problems with using a virus. One is that you've obviously got to get your corrected DNA into the viral DNA, right? Well, we can do that. That's not such a hard problem to get around. We've got the technology to be able to do that, and then we can grow up viral particles in human cell tissue culture and harvest the viruses. So it's probably not so hard to do that. Second problem is that viruses, when they infect, usually are harmful in one way or another. You know, probably the most common virus would be the human cold virus. Right, and you think, well, okay, if we're going to use human cold viruses to get the DNA in, are we going to give everybody nasty colds in the process? Or other viruses that may be more specific for what we want, are we going to cause diseases that way? So you have to make sure that your virus is not a fully functional virus, so that it will infect, but it won't go through its complete life cycle. It won't be producing more viral particles. Or actually, it would be kind of cool if it did, but if it just wouldn't cause the disease. You know, what's the problem that it causes in the cell? So you could kind of design the virus so that it's carrying
gene that you want to carry, so that it's able to infect, so that it can, that gene can get inserted into the host DNA and so forth. But, and maybe even that virus, it'll make more new viral particles, but it doesn't cause the problem, which is asking a lot, really asking a lot. That's almost too much to hope for. Question? Well, I'm not talking about multiple shots. The question was, would there be negative effects to getting multiple shots at once? And, I can imagine, but you know, in the ideal world, you would treat the individual once, and that would take care of it. Now, this is an ideal world, so how do you develop these things? But yeah, problems. Now, here's another problem with viruses. And that is that oftentimes when they insert their DNA into the human genome, into the human DNA, they don't care where it gets inserted. It could be inserted randomly anywhere. Now that might be okay as long as it doesn't get inserted in the middle of a gene that you need. If it gets inserted in the middle of a gene that you need, now all of a sudden you're missing something else that's going to create problems. So if you're going to use a virus, you need to be really careful to pick a virus that always inserts in one particular place, and there are viruses like that out there, always inserts its DNA in one place, and it's not in the middle of something else that you need. So you want it to be inserting in a relatively harmless area so that you can then get that gene in. Here's another challenge, and that is how do you get the gene into the cells that you really need to infect. So let's go back to sickle cell anemia, right? You don't need to change every cell in an individual that has sickle cell anemia. You need to change the cells in the bone marrow that are producing the red blood cells. Those are the ones you need to go after. And if you could just get your corrected gene into all of those cells, then hey, you'd be well on your way maybe to curing that in that individual. So how do you go about doing that? Well, what you would wind up doing probably is pulling bone marrow out of the individual. So you're going to collect what we call stem cells, which are cells that are constantly dividing and producing new red blood cells. You're going to pull these cells from the individual and have a way of growing them in the lab so that you can culture them. And in the lab, then you can go ahead and use your virus to infect them. You can get, you know, pretty close to 100% infection rate if you do it right in the lab. What about all the bone marrow cells that are still in the individual? The ones with the bad DNA? Well, you got to kill them. So one of the risks of this kind of technology is you pull the bone marrow out. You use chemicals to kill, or other means to kill, all the rest of the bone marrow cells, so that you can then once you've changed this set of bone marrow cells and corrected the DNA, then you can transplant those back into the individual. And the nice thing about doing it this way is that rejection problems are kind of probably be minimal because you're using cells that came from that individual to begin with. So the body isn't going to say, oh, no, there are foreign invaders, got to get rid of them. It's going to see them as their own cells. So put them back in. Hopefully they take hold. And if they do, then you're going to be producing red blood cells now that are corrected. They're now producing proper hemoglobin, not sickle cell hemoglobin. Okay, so there's a lot of things that one has to go through, a lot of techniques and so forth, and we're still working on those kinds of things. I mean, nothing has been perfected yet. Yeah.
Is this similar to or the same process used as far as bone marrow transplants from, you know, like UDU or whatever, just the same process?
Yeah, if you have a lymphoma, cancer of the bone marrow or something, it's a similar kind of thing. Except there, they wouldn't withdraw any. They would just kill all the cells and then transplant from the donor again. And that's actually fairly successful anymore. You know, that's been done enough that, that people know how to do it. The problem is, oftentimes, those individuals have to be on immunosuppressive drugs for the rest of their life, and that opens up some other issues. But, yeah. Now, a few years ago, in medical, in certain medical areas, they tried starting some of these types of things. Right now, I can't remember what the first trial was for, that they were using viral vectors to go in and correct the DNA and so forth, but it had to be stopped fairly soon because like a huge percent of the people, it was just a very, very small sample size, but a huge percent died from unexpected side effects and so forth. So you always got to deal with those kinds of things too. What are the side effects? Even though you think what you're doing is going to be relatively harmless, when you actually do it and get it into the body. And so watch, every so often in the news, you'll hear about a trial where this kind of technology is being used. And the good news is it's getting better. Bad news is people are still dying. You know, there's still things that we don't fully understand and know about this. But somewhere down the road, this technology is probably going to mature and be used to resolve certain kinds of genetically inherited diseases that people have. Now, here's the other bad thing to this. That is that if you're able to correct it in the individual, you still haven't corrected it in the germline, which means that they will still pass those defective genes on to the next generation. So you might be able to correct it in the individual. What do you do about the next generation? It's really, really dicey to start fooling with the germline, with the cells that are going to become the sperm or the eggs, because you don't, you know, if you make a mistake there, you don't know what you're going to wind up with in the next generation. So how do you deal with that? Well, probably where this might be heading into the future would be to correct the error at the very beginning. All right, so if you could take a fertilized egg that's divided maybe a few times, and you could identify it as carrying the sickle cell gene, which you can do, then if you could go in and apply your correction at that point, then you'd be correcting everything. You'd be correcting all of the cells, right? So that as that individual developed and matured, they wouldn't be carrying the problem anymore. We're not there. I don't think we're even close to there yet, but that would be the ultimate resolution of this kind of a problem, to go in and correct it that way, using some sort of a vector and DNA technology. So that's kind of the hope of all this. That's one way that this technology might be used. Yeah? Okay, if start messing with the DNA and genes, does that mean you've got a different person? I guess it would depend on how you define that person. If you just change their hair color, you have a different person. You just change this or that. But then there could be other things, unexpected consequences, that could really significantly change the way the individual acts and responds. So I don't quite know how to answer that question. It kind of depends on how you define that individual.
So if you start
changing people's genes, eventually you're going
to be a GMO. Say
that last part again about the
GMO.
So you
say
start changing people's genes.
Is that going to
be
genetically modified?
Oh, GMO people.
Yeah,
that'd be cool. Yeah, that's
definitely
No, we don't do that in the United States.
I was going to say, the next thing that we might talk about here is GMOs. Because GMOs are kind of a similar thing. We're not trying to correct defects that way, but we're trying to insert what seem to be useful genes into a species for our own benefit. And let's take a break now, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about what's going on there.
don't ask me to say it.
Okay, let's talk about GMOs for just a minute. And I've got another thing I want to talk to you about too, so I'm not going to dwell on this very much, but GMOs are an outcome of this kind of technology. Right, so one form of GMO, I suppose, is the person who's cured of a disease because they've been able to use to replace the gene. However, they're really not, because we're using human genes to replace human genes, right? So GMO, they're really defined as organisms that have had a gene from another species inserted into them. Now, why in the world would we want to do that? One of the earliest GMOs was corn. And there was a particular pest that would attack the cornfields and so forth. And for a long time, farmers were spraying a bacterium over the field, which produced a toxin, which became known as BT, which stands for the scientific name of the organism. So this BT toxin, produced by the bacteria, when the caterpillars would eat it, it would kill them. Right? So that was a way of kind of a natural pest control in the fields. And then people got to thinking, well, wait a minute, why can't we just take that BT gene out of the bacteria and put it into the corn, so we no longer have to spray the corn with the bacteria. You save all that money, no longer have to spray it. And so when the caterpillars eat the corn leaf, they eat the toxin and it kills them. So that was the idea behind that, that first, or one of the earliest genetically modified organisms, and that indeed has happened, and the debate still rages about GMO corn. But that's one of the genes that's been put in there now. So that it can kind of act like its own pest control. Kinds of questions that are asked, you know, what about people that might be sensitive to the BT toxin? I mean, in general, it doesn't kill us. Most people it wouldn't affect at all. But there may be some people that are sensitive, maybe allergic to it and so forth. If they don't know it's a GMO corn with the BT toxin in it, then that could have real problems for them, life-threatening kinds of problems. So that's one of the controversies that kind of swirls around that. Now, there's another gene that they're working on inserting into various crop plants. I'm sure corn would be included, which would give them resistance to certain herbicides like Roundup. Roundup is a very effective herbicide, killing plants and so forth. And the idea there is, if you could insert this particular gene, and apparently it's a single gene again, that gives them the resistance, if you could insert that gene in, then you could have your crop growing, all the weeds start to grow up. Well, hey, just go in and spray the whole field with Roundup, and the weeds will die, but your resistant crop will survive and thrive. So that's the idea, and more recent controversy has come out. Monsanto is one of the companies that is supporting this kind of research and working on it. So that's one of the more recent controversies. Again, we're taking genes from elsewhere and we're adding them. In this case, we're giving the plant resistance, either whether it's to a pest that's eating it or to some other chemical we're spraying in the environment. There's another one. There are certain bacteria that are really resistant to freezing. So when the temperature gets down to like what we had last night, some bacteria are very resistant to that. They don't freeze. Well, they probably were frozen last night, but around 28, 30 degrees, they don't freeze. And so the gene has been isolated for the protein that gives them that ability, and it's been put into some crop plants so that they can be raised in maybe a little bit more extreme weather conditions. So that if it gets really cold and freezes and the farmer wasn't expecting it or whatever, it doesn't destroy the crop. So that's another example of a GMO. I can't remember what crop that's been put into, but that's another example of a GMO. And GMOs are becoming more and more common out there. We're not aware of that because our foods are not labeled as GMO. In Europe, most things I think have to be labeled as GMOs and so forth. And it seems like every so often we get some sort of opportunity to vote on something like this, should we label foods or not, and so forth. But that's the whole GMO thing, and you can take that to any extreme that you want to take it to. Yeah?
Related to that,
about the new study like
GM salmon? I'm not on GM salmon. I mean, salmon. What are they putting in the salmon?
Well, that's my question to you. They are trying to genetically modify salmon to make them resistant to, the extremes of the temperature.
Okay, so we have to be careful when we're talking about this, and not knowing anything about what you're talking about, but for thousands of years, people have done selective breeding. And that's one way to, and a lot of our the animals that we use for food now, and the plants and so forth, are the result of selective breeding. They're not GMOs. They're selectively bred to enhance certain traits. Sometimes that's successful, sometimes it isn't. So I don't know whether that's what they're doing, but if you're through GMO, then you're going to be transplanting.
They're just called GMOs.
Yes.
I literally just did a report on this actually based on passing Frankie fish that's mostly in Alaska. And it's about 35 different species of fish, not just salmon, but it's bass and a couple of it. And they're taking parts of humans, rats, coral, and a couple other things, including other fish, bringing them into these GMO fish to make them grow twice as fast as they normally do, just to make them market faster, so it's financially sensitive. And they're also trying to make them less disease ridden and bring them into like natural populations of fish and brain. And so they're kind of like trying to breed the super fish and breed these fish in with the regular fish, so they're like creating more super fish.
Okay, so you're saying that genes from several different sources being put into as many as 35 different species of fish, and in order to make them better able to survive extremes and also make them grow faster and so forth up in Alaska. The hand went down. Okay. Yeah.
Can we get the same results from selective breeding of GMOs?
No. And I would say that because with two GMOs, you're really doing something different. You're presumably with a true GMO, you're giving them genes from another species that are going to have certain effects that you probably can never accomplish with selective breeding. And that's why you go to the GMO. That's why you go to this other route. And one of the biggest concerns about GMOs early on was them getting into the natural populations. Because once you get those genes out there, you can't recall them. And what effect will that have on the natural populations? What effect will it have on, say, the seed banks of some of the old unmodified species and so forth? You see it starting to wind up in those now. And what perils does that hold for the future? That's what people are concerned about. Yeah. It could. Sure, if you make something that survives better, say, that could, depending on everything else that's going on in that ecosystem, yeah, it could upset the balance and have trickle-down effects all over the place. Yeah. Yep. Okay. So, GMO.
That's a heated discussion. So,
what was that?
That GMO is just a heated discussion. Yeah.
It is. It is. And I think we're going to end right now because there's some other stuff I want to talk about too that I think you'll find interesting. So, GMOs are an outgrowth of genetic engineering, right? That's what they are. I want to talk about probes. I'm not talking about the little satellites that get sent out from the mothership to look at the planet. Okay, we're talking about, but it's kind of similar to that. Probes are pieces of DNA. They tend to be about 21, 22 nucleotides long, 21 to 23 nucleotides, let's say, that are a unique sequence for something that we're looking for. Why 21 to 23 nucleotides? If you figure the odds, what are the odds of any region of DNA in an organism having the exact same 23 nucleotides, say, as your probe? Odds would be extremely, extremely low. So what we do is we'll make a probe that is however long, okay? And this is single-stranded DNA, a single strand of DNA. The idea is, let's say we're concerned about a disease. I don't want to pick on sickle cell again. Let's pick on something else. What's that?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's a real complex. Let's not go there. That's incredibly complex. I'm trying to think of a single gene disease, and I know a billion of them, and I can't think of any right now. Okay, so much for that. I don't want to pick on sickle cell. Come on. Thalassemia. Okay, what is that? Thalassemia. It's a nice big name. Thalassemia is another blood disease. It's one that is probably not quite as bad as sickle cell, but it creates problems for the individuals, and they wind up with anemia and so forth. Thalassemia. So let's suppose you have, and some of the thalassemias, I believe, are recessive. So you can have an individual that shows a perfectly normal blood, but you know thalassemia is running in their family line. So I want to know if this person is a carrier for thalassemia. So what you would do is take and sequence the thalassemia gene and look for a unique little sequence. It's a little 21 to 23 nucleotide long sequence. Find that sequence and then create your own DNA, single-stranded DNA molecule. It will be complementary to that sequence. And the idea is then, if you take a DNA sample from the individual, amplify the DNA from that region, and then you split the DNA apart. We use the term denaturing again. Now remember, with proteins, denaturing was uncoiling and winding and making it inactive. In DNA, denaturing is separating the two strands. So we would separate the two strands and then add our probe. And if the probe sticks, and there are ways of seeing if it sticks, if the probe sticks, then that tells us that gene is there, at least that sequence is there. And if we've made that specialized sequence to that gene that we're looking for, then we know that that person's carrying that gene, even though they haven't expressed that gene. Now, how do you know if the probe sticks? So the probes always have some sort of a signaling molecule attached to them. So I'll just draw it like that. This is the signal. Initially, those signaling molecules were radioactive labels, so that you would have to then examine this and see if the radioactive label stayed with the DNA and so forth. But now, what's commonly used is an enzyme that will cause a color reaction to occur. So you would just add a certain substrate. Once you've denatured your DNA, you've added the probe, let it sit for a while so that it's got a chance to absorb or to be picked up by the DNA. Then you wash it out. You want to clean as much of it out as you can. So if the probe didn't anneal to the DNA, if it didn't find the appropriate region, it'd get all washed out. And then what you would do is to kind of lay your DNA out and look and see if we've got the signal there. So in this case, it will typically it'll turn a white substance blue. So you're looking for a little blue signal to show up, and that tells you then that gene, that the probe was stuck to the DNA, that the gene was there. And this kind of technology is really well developed now, and it's used in a number of instances, not only for identifying genes. There's some nasty genes out there that cause diseases later in life. You know, as you go through life, your body is physiologically constantly changing and so forth. And there are some of these things that just don't even get triggered until maybe the 50s or the 60s. And you wonder, you know, am I a carrier for this or not? I know that this come through my family. Oftentimes, they're dominant traits. And so if one parent has it, you've got a 50-50 chance that you've inherited it also. Do you want to know if you've got that? Or the BCRA 1 and 2 genes for breast cancer or this or that. Do we want to know? Are we carrying those or not? So we can go ahead and do a DNA workup, use the appropriate probes, and use that as a mechanism for determining whether the individual has that gene, is a carrier for that gene or not. Of course, the problem is, what do you do with that information? I mean, you say, oh, if you show that you're clear of it, then you know, oh, that's a relief. But then if you show that you're carrying that gene, then you got to think, okay, now what am I going to do with that information? But it's used for a lot of different diseases now. The cystic fibrosis that you look at in lab, that 4 pages worth of DNA and stuff, there are probes that are used to probe for the cystic fibrosis genes and so forth. So it's very, very common. So one thing that we use the probes for is to identify genes that, that may not be necessarily showing up. We suspect they're in the family lineage. You may or may not have inherited it. Let's use a probe to specifically go looking for that gene. And as more and more genes for different genetic defects are identified, then we add to our tool chest. We get more and more probes that can be used to look for that. So that's one use. Another use is in DNA fingerprinting. So let's talk about DNA fingerprinting a little bit. And DNA fingerprinting comes back to our restriction endonucleases, but this time we're going to want to use a blunt end cutter. So we want to cut the DNA up into little pieces that won't re-anneal back together. Okay, so we use a blunt end cutter for that. And so we can add a restriction nuclease, break up the DNA, then what in the world do we do with that? You'll take that DNA sample. Now this may be just a small sample of DNA that you've amplified by PCR. I would suggest you don't do it with the whole genome, but sometimes it does get done that way. But maybe a small sample, you've amplified it. You want to know if a particular sequence is there or not. So you can have probes that will identify certain sequences. Now, how do we, but the first question is, how do we run these out? And we use a process called electrophoresis. So we got a gel, literally a gel, kind of like Jell-O, only it's not. It's a protein that's kind of a mess of knots and so forth. That's what a gel is. It's liquid with a mess of knots in it. And what we'll do is we'll have this gel and we'll have little holes at the top. And these are what we call wells. Little holes at the top of the gel. We'll add a DNA sample here. So we've cut up our DNA and so forth, and we'll add it to there, and then we'll apply an electric voltage. Now, at the normal pHs of these things, the DNA tends to have a negative charge on it. Okay, so we're going to apply a voltage. This is going to be negative up here, and this is going to be positive down here. So a voltage across here. Now, the DNA with a negative charge is going to be attracted to the positive pole. It'll be repelled from there and attracted to here. And what will happen, we've now cut up our DNA with the blunt end cutter, right? And we're going to have all sorts of different sizes of pieces of DNA as a result of that, because it's just cutting based on those palindromic regions that it finds. The shorter the DNA is, the farther it's going to travel, because it has an easier time threading its way through this gel matrix that it's got to go through. So the shorter pieces are going to travel farther, the longer pieces are going to kind of get stuck up in this region. They're not going to be able to travel very far. So what we're going to wind up with eventually is a pattern of some sort, where shortest down here, longest up here, and just maybe a whole bunch of different intermediates in there. We can visualize those in different ways. There are certain things that we can use that simply identify DNA. So if you stain them with one of those, like one example would be ethidium bromide that you don't need to remember, but we can stain it with that, and under a black light you can see the pattern. Okay, so there's our pattern. But if you want to be more specific, you can take probes, certain probes, and then after you've run this out, there are other things that you have to do. You apply the probe, and not every one of these is going to have the probe attached to it. So we're going to be much more specific in the kind of a pattern that we find here than we do if we just look at all the DNA. And that becomes the DNA fingerprint, the idea that every person should have a unique pattern of the DNA. And we're not there yet. We're not to the point where we can get completely unique patterns to the DNA, but that's the idea. Where we're at is where somebody might say, well, there's a 1 in 1,000,000 chance that anybody would have this pattern, or a 1 in 5,000,000 chance that anybody would have this pattern. And then you've got to figure out, well, what are the odds of certain things and so forth. So anyway, that's the idea behind DNA fingerprinting. So we're using electricity to do that. Now, let's look at this example. Here's a real simple example. Okay, so here's a gel that I've run out. Four little lanes, okay, top, minus, plus, so there's a power, there are wells. And let's say that you have a crime scene where there was some blood left behind. And you think it was the perpetrator's blood that got left behind. Okay, we've got some suspects. How are we going to figure out which perpetrator or which suspect was the perpetrator with the perpetrator's blood left behind, if indeed any of these suspects match? So you go ahead and work up the DNA. You cut it up. You run out the electrophoresis. You apply a selection of probes or whatever. Here's the pattern that you get. So we can look at this. Now, let's suppose that this lane was the crime scene. So there's the pattern of the DNA of the crime scene. Okay, three different suspects. Well, this one has a totally different pattern. This one has a totally different pattern. But, ooh, look at this one. The same pattern. So we say, oh, it looks like suspect number three over here, the patterns match. Therefore, to a certain degree of certainty, we can say that that was the suspect that was that left the blood at the crime scene. So that's the basis for DNA testing, or DNA fingerprinting. It depends on the selection of probes that you might use and so forth in terms of what that pattern might look like, but you're trying to isolate identical patterns. So you have a picture of a more realistic picture of the gel in the lecture notes. This was the simplified one. So here's another one. So this time the blood from the crime scene is in the middle lane, and we're looking at all these other patterns here. Now they've kind of made it easy for it, or it turned out to be easy, because you're looking for a similar pattern, and everybody is different except for lane 3. Right? And lane 3 is very, very similar. So exactly. I think whoever donated lane 3 is the one that left the blood at the crime scene. The DNA fingerprinting. So DNA fingerprinting is used for criminal investigations. It's used for paternity, trying to figure out if a man is the father of a particular child. You can use DNA fingerprinting. That way it's used for figuring out ancestral linkages and so forth. There was a time down in South America, one of the South American countries, where babies were being stolen. And they were being given to high government officials. And in fact, there were cases where pregnant women in their eighth and ninth months were being kidnapped. And a little while later, their bodies would be found. The babies had been delivered. They'd been killed after the babies were delivered. It's like, how do we match these babies up to the families where they belong? So when they got some of the children that were suspect, they could use DNA fingerprinting. And this time, rather than using nuclear DNA, they used a little bit of DNA that's in the mitochondria. Mitochondria are all inherited from our moms. So they could use these kinds of techniques and actually identify lineages where these babies belong, put them back into their appropriate families on the maternal side by using DNA fingerprinting. So it's really a powerful tool, and it's really getting more powerful all the time. And I think I've run out of time, so thank you all. And don't forget the question and answer times. And I'll see you all online at some point for the quiz, the last test.
Unless it looks good for you to have a child that is a child. What if the child is a child?
Okay, I'm just gonna...